Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of The Sewers of Paris. Join us on tonight's episode when my guests Mitch and Greg talk about how it got better.
Coming out is hard to your parents because it's like you're having to have the sex talk with your parents.
The topic is Rosie O'Donnell, Modern Family, and Survivor. I've got two guests on this episode. Mitch and Greg are the creators of the super popular YouTube series ASAP Science, among many other projects. They met many years ago through a Facebook hack and grew close as they searched for a way to blend their love of science and their love of art. And along the way, they built a quirky queer science empire together as creative partners and life partners. Big thanks to everyone who makes the show possible, including bonus episodes like this one. You can join those folks. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum. Check out the rewards for patrons, including a care package in the mail with Sewers of Paris stuff. And for more queer podcasting, check out my show Queens of Adventure, featuring drag queens on an epic Dungeons & Dragons quest. That's at queensofadventure.com. Now, here's Mitch and Greg. Well, this week I'm speaking to Greg and Mitch, the creators of ASAP Science and the podcast Side Note, queer science communicators. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
So, what is the entertainment that changed each of your lives?
Mitch, you go first.
Okay. So this is Mitch. I have like kind of two. There's like two things that define me in the eyes of most people that know me. The things that I love the most are Survivor and Zelda. And for whatever reason, like I've never over reflected on why these things have been so significant in my life. But even when I was young, like I'd collect memorabilia from both those things. Like when I traveled, I would enjoy collecting like masks that reminded me of Survivor. And like, I don't know, there's something about, I think, like the interpersonal relationships that fascinated me, as well as then Zelda was kind of like this solo adventure spirited thing that you could travel around and experiencing something on your own. And I don't know, maybe we'll find out that has like deep-seated like issues and like being alone and feeling separate from the world. But yeah, I think those are kind of like the two entertainment pieces that to this day I still identify with.
Well, and Zelda, you know, is not without masks as a mechanic at certain points.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, like Majora's Mask as a game is literally, yeah, collecting masks, using them to change your identity, to be able to access different parts of the world and interact in totally different ways. And so, yeah, maybe there is some weird connection between like the iconography between Survivor and Zelda in some way. But yeah, that's absolutely true.
And, you know, of course, they're both games. They're both, you know, you're not exactly competing in Zelda, but still, like, there's challenges to overcome.
Yeah, I guess it's, like, it's the thought of this puzzle. Like, I've always loved Survivor, and I also do, like, Big Brother, the show, as well. I think they're just, like, puzzles that rely on more than just a literal puzzle. Like, you have to interact in social ways, and even in Zelda, you're, like, interacting with NPCs and characters that give you pieces of information, and the way they behave helps you solve different problems, and I think that is something there that I just found really fascinating as a young person and today.
Greg, how about you?
Okay, so mine's definitely nothing to do with video games. I famously have, like, never played one. But I think the entertainment that shaped me was the Rosie O'Donnell show. So, like, my family was obsessed. Like, it's kind of weird because the way that I grew up, my family wasn't, they weren't really a huge proponent of watching TV. We had very strict TV times. Like, we could only watch half an hour a day, but like, Rosie never counted. It was like the whole family was just like obsessed. Like, and looking back on it, I mean, I've thought about this a lot because obviously, I mean, Donald Trump is president, like her arch nemesis. Like, there's so many weird things because we were really so obsessed with the way that she interviewed people. And obviously, you know, celebrity and pop culture was something I was like loved. But I think more than importantly, it was like she was for sure an activist. Like, she was something that's completely missing. I guess it's coming back a little bit now with like Stephen Colbert and stuff, like asking real questions. But even at her like 4 p.m. time slot, she would challenged like people who worked for or who were endorsing the NRA. Like, she wasn't afraid to actually like speak on who she actually was. I think it was an incredibly queer show. Like, the way that she like propped up queer people, propped up like Broadway. Like, I'm not from New York, but I was like obsessed with the concept of like Broadway musicals because I was educated like through Rosie O'Donnell. She brought Harry Potter to America. Like, she really was.
She also loved Survivor, famously.
Loved Survivor. That was another reason why my family probably allowed me to watch Survivor. Like, she was a key holder for culture for so long, and also just like a really like an activist and a queer person. And I just think even, I don't know, she's aged well. Like, her show has aged well, and I just looking back on it, it was such an important part of, like, my family's, like, life and time together. And looking back, it's not one of those things that I'm like, oh, that's awkward. Like, that, I'm shameful of it. In fact, it was, like, incredible. Just like Oprah, too. Both of them. they're missing in the world.
Yeah, you know, I don't think people give Rosie enough credit for, you know, I guess how groundbreaking what she was doing was. Like, it wasn't just a talk show. It was, you know, coming at a time when there had just been, like, this glut of cheap talk shows in like the early to mid 90s. And then she was there with like a very different personality. And also, like you say, that activism, like actually challenging people and, you know, giving right. Like to it must've been really meaningful to you. Like you mentioned the Broadway stuff, like, was that like your main exposure to that kind of that medium?
Yeah, 100%. And she was, she also got obsessed with things, which I think was really interesting and endearing. A lot of celebrities like to appear like immune to culture or immune to, you know, like almost like too cool. That's a way of appearing. But she was never like that. She was always, you know, she'd be like, I just saw The Lion King musical for the 7th night in a row. Like, we're going to have them all come and like walk down the aisle as elephants and all these things. Like, I don't know. You could tell that she actually loved what she wanted to prop up. She wasn't just propping these things up because the promo tour was happening and therefore they had to talk about
right.
it. And I think that is missing, that realness. And yeah, she gets such a bad rep due to sexism and homophobia. Like, literally the way that people perceive Rosie is, like, the same thing that happens when any woman speaks up, or, like, especially a queer woman. You know, like, she's too loud, she's too abrasive. But it's like, oh, wow, she called out Donald Trump. Like, wow. Maybe we should have been listening to her at the time. Oh, wow, she called out, like, conservatives. I don't know. I just, like, actually, wow, I'm getting, like, heated now. Because I'm like, she really... It bothers me so much that people don't give her the credit she deserves and also think of her as, like, a loud mouth who, like, was opinionated for not the right reasons. Justice for Rosie.
What you've kind of got with her is sort of the opposite of masks. Like, you're really seeing the genuine... This is sincerely who she is. This is not somebody who's, like, putting on airs.
Yeah, exactly. And that is so missing. It's so... nice to see a celebrity geek out when they meet people. She cried when Barbara Streisand came on and changed the whole so that it would be Barbara's
the other
right side.
Yeah.
And she's vulnerable saying how much her mom, who had passed away, like loved Barbara Streisand. Like, that's missing from the world of entertainment, seeing people be real. That's so rare now.
That's true. I will say, like, it does seem like there's been a rise in just fandom in general. Like, it's cool to like stuff in a way that it might not have been, 20 or so years ago when she got started.
Yeah, that's true. Hamilton. She would have what?
Yep.
What would she have done
she
for Hamilton?
Loved
she would have gone crazy.
Oh, man. Yeah, gosh, I can't even imagine. So you mentioned, both of you mentioned it's sort of Survivor fandom, sort of, like, and then that it was something that you watched as a family, which is so intriguing to me because I hear that from some queer people that, like, Survivor was super important to them, and you would not initially think that it would be, like, it's just not what you would think of stereotypically as, like, there's no diva involved, or, you know, it doesn't feel
it's
queer,
so weird.
But...
We talk about this a lot, that there is a weird link to, like, not just all reality TV, but specifically Survivor and Big Brother have, like, both really big queer followings, but not for a very obvious reason.
But this is so anecdotal. It's like our personal friends, right? Like, it's not something that we've necessarily noticed.
I've noticed online. Like, I'm on both subreddits for Survivor and Big Brother, and I get the sense that a lot of them also love, like, RuPaul's Drag Race and are, like, fans of that kind of queer internet culture that... But yeah, I've never fully addressed why.
Recently we watched this TV show, The Other Two. It's like it's a new show. It comes on after Broad City. It's written by some people, like a gay guy who writes for SNL. And they make a joke in it about the roommate who is masked and he must be straight because he watches Survivor.
Yeah.
And we both were like, wait, that's a tone-deaf note because in our heads, it's
like
gay Survivor's to watch
like,
Survivor.
Yeah, that is really strange. There's a Fran Drescher quote where she says something like, she's trying to be supportive, and she says something like, if you removed all the cultural contributions of gay people from entertainment, you'd be left with The Price is Right, which is kind of a funny quote, but also like, I just have spoken to enough people and have friends who work in that industry to know, like, the entire game show industry is run by queer people. So it's like,
yeah, it's like, so then you're left with nothing.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Looking back, was there something like about Survivor in particular? Like, it would have come on at a time when you were both like kind of middle schoolish, probably.
Yeah,
so
we would
what
have
I'd
been...
say is that I don't think Survivor really was that shaping for me. I honestly think that I personally, my family watched it because it was a big cultural phenomenon, and Rosie okayed it. Like, I'm not even kidding. This is more, I think, for you, Mitch.
Oh,
but
yeah.
There's hot guys and like not wearing many clothes.
But that, like, for me, this is Mitch. That never, like, it's not that it didn't appeal to me. Like, I wasn't out then. I didn't quite really understand my sexuality then. It's interesting that the very first season of Survivor, like a gay man won. And weirdly enough, like I didn't watch the first season live. I remember hearing the premise and hearing people talk about it, but not being that interested. But then they replayed the whole season, I think in the summer, like back to back every single night. And my dad and I got so into it. And then from there, I've never missed an episode. But now looking back also, it's very... Looking back on how the media also like treated Richard Hatch, he was like a villain, which he played up the villain role. But I also think there's so many more layers to it, him being gay.
So it was
and kind
homophobic
of,
the way they edited
yeah,
it.
Yeah, looking back on like how, not necessarily how they edited it, but how like the audience perceived him. I have no idea if that impacted me as like a sort of, not unsuspecting gay man, but at the time I don't remember thinking like...
In a bad way even, you mean?
Possibly, but I don't remember thinking like, I'm gay and now I feel weird about this other gay man. Like I wasn't, yeah. I think I was maybe like 10 or 11, so
but
I hadn't
young
quite...
young gay people, you can't ever be that aware enough. Like,
yeah, it certainly impacted me. Yeah, and I've looked back on some like think pieces about him and how it was covered about how he was like put in jail for like tax fraud and like the way the media has covered him has often like misconstrued information.
Well, back to Donald Trump, Mark Burnett, who makes Survivor, is a huge funder of Donald Trump and an extremely dangerous person. And he made Survivor, and who knows, he obviously wouldn't have been like. It's not like I picture him as like a queer. Forward-thinking ally.
No. But I mean, I think going back to the show, there is something about, like, it's this personal interaction, this idea that you can almost, like, control your environment through the way you act with people. And I wonder if
that's what gay people do when they grow up.
Yeah, I wonder if that's a really fascinating point for gay people to not only observe, but imagine in their own lives, right? Because we navigate the entire world. I mean, many people before they come out especially navigate the entire world by trying to form to other people and please other people and not stand out. And that's kind of like what you need to do in a game like Survivor. You have to constantly adjust your attitude and your personality to mold to other people to get what you want, essentially. And maybe that's like the fascinating element of it. And I think, I mean, there's been many gay people on Survivor, and I think a lot of them have done well. I don't have any stat about that. But yeah, it's definitely just a fascinating place where you can view personal interactions in a way that no other show really captures, I think.
You know, it's true what you said about a lot of queer people have to learn to be people pleasers just for our own safety. And it's kind of interesting to see how Richard Hatch was able to sort of weaponize that, or at least turn it into a strategy to take advantage of a situation where it was all about telling people what they wanted to hear and getting along and, you know, playing into what was, well, I guess what has been for a long time a stereotype of queer people as manipulators. And I guess, you know, it's sort of him saying like, all right, well, if that's what you think of me, I'm going to use it to win $1 million.
For sure. I've rewatched that first season and he is like a fascinating, amazing character. And it is weird that he was pitched as like this evil man because he actually is just quite intelligent and was really smart in it and was never mean or cruel to anyone. Was just like, hey, this is a giant board game. And he was kind of the first person to realize that before anyone had come up with the idea of alliances and things like that. Like he not made that word, but in the context of a game like that, he really was the first person to spearhead that.
Did you realize watching that, or maybe watching Rosie, or like at some point that you were watching a queer person and there was something about that person that was resonating with who you are?
I don't know. It's so interesting because like I think for Rosie, it was like a big deal for us when she came out, but it doesn't surprise me that all of that's what I mean. I do think it's a queer show. All of her interests were queer. She never was out, but she didn't ever hide who she truly was as a person. And I think that bled through to, like, my, like, love of her. She was being true to herself. Even though she came out only near the end of it, it's not like she was the type of person who was, like, living a lie. Like, she had such a queer outlook on life that I think, yeah, of course it resonated with me. But I wouldn't have been able to consciously know because I was too young. I came out.
When did Rosie come out?
She came out on the last season of her show. She came out on Will and Grace, kind of.
Oh, and then was she out on her talk show after that?
Yeah, like on Will and Grace, she's like this moment where she kind of comes out as gay. I remember I was like screaming, like my whole family was watching it. And then I think she kind of came out after. It wasn't the way it sort of would be now, where it's like a press release and all this kind of stuff. Mm. But she was out in her, she says, because she loved Tom Cruise. And so she said, I love, when she came out, she sort of was like, because everyone was like, wait, you were always obsessed with Tom Cruise. Mm-hmm. And you said he was so cute. Like, was that a lie? And she was like, no, I love Tom Cruise in the way I wish that he would just mow my lawn and give me lemonade. And her whole series ends with Tom Cruise making a little video, mowing the lawn.
Oh,
and
my God. I've never seen that.
Isn't that poignant? It is.
It's really sweet.
Yeah.
I know. It's really sweet. It's like, it's queer. It's like literally like an acknowledgement of the fact that mm-hmm. she's a lesbian. That's how it ends. Like, yeah, you were always... true. You never lied.
Right. It wasn't a full front that she was just like trying to hide herself by being endeared to and by.
She was just saying the right things that she could at the time. Ugh, anyways, Rosie.
So did that impact your queerness? I mean, obviously when she came out, it probably did, but.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think of like coming out as so separate from that, but I think it definitely did. And that my whole family was obsessed with these queer things like Broadway. And I don't know, like, again, what she loved my family.
And you have, like, a very progressive family, right, in the first place?
Yeah, exactly. But it was also nice to see her, like, you know, if she was anti-gun and would challenge people, like, my family would be so proud of her and things like that. That allowed me to, like, be like, okay, this is the way I should feel about the world. Mm. Literally, we copied her. Like, anything that she liked, we liked. Like, Macy Gray. My mom was obsessed with Macy Gray.
It's
like,
so funny.
And there was a song, like, a supermatic, sexy, there's a song called Sex Freak, and my mom used to sing it all the time.
Because Rosie loved it.
Because Rosie loved it. I'm like, I don't know if you realize you're singing like about how you're obsessed with sex. But Rosie liked it, so.
Where did that fall, like, in relation to your own comings out? Like, was that helpful, or were you already out, or, like, what was the timeline?
Yeah, no, I came out when I was 16 at the beginning of grade 12, and Rosie O'Donnell was off the air before that, I think. It was very separate for me.
But how did that wind up happening?
Me coming out?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I remember I was like, it was during the summer. It was like, I mean, obviously being attracted to the same sex for a long period of time. And I had lots of, like, in high school, I was really good at, even though I sound extremely flamboyant, I was able to, like, mask my queerness. Like, The Velvet Rage is that book that a lot of gay guys read. And it was like, the way I was able to cope was being really confident and, like, funny and making sure that people liked me. And so I was able to, like, have girlfriends and, like, have sexual experiences with girls, even though I was so flamboyant. So I was able to actually know, okay, I am as – I mean, I think I – obviously sexuality is fluid, and I am actually kind of attracted to girls in certain ways from those experiences, but able to know I am definitely more attracted to men. And then I remember, like, lying in my bed almost, like, horny and being like, wait, if I just, like, come out, I could then act on these sexual desires that I have. And it didn't feel that far off. I'm like – I needed to come out before I could do that for some reason. I know lots of gay men just do it and come out later. But in my head, that's what I need to do. And I remember it was almost like a light bulb moment where I was like so excited to like hook up with a guy by coming out. And so I remember I was alone like the summer off, like at camp, away from high school, away from that. Then when I went back in the fall, I was like, I'm going to do this. Told my closest friends, like, let it bleed out. And then it was amazing. As soon as I came out, all the bullying and things that people had said about me like didn't matter anymore because I was out. And it gave me such a strong confidence to fight back. And obviously, like many gay people probably say, it was the best decision of my life.
But you did it like younger than a lot of people. You know what I mean? Like 16, like going into grade 12, like we don't even have that many friends that came out in high school. It's almost like I think a lot of people wait till they've kind of escaped the grasp of high school and then they start their university or their real career or whatever.
I grew up in a major city. I grew up in Toronto. There was this thing called Homo Hop, which was like through the University of Toronto, which was an all ages like gay club night, which became where I would go with my friends and actually like have a lot of fun. It was like they'd never gone out clubbing. We would go to like this gay club thing. Like I think being in a major city is helpful. There was lots of other gay people my age who I got to like meet. But one thing I do realize is I never acted sexually on my gayness until coming out, which I think a lot of people are like,
it's almost like the opposite.
Yeah, just do it. Yeah, don't tell anyone.
I was like, I came out like when Greg and I started dating, basically. Like we met in university, we were in the same program, and yeah, we were just like studying. I was like, I used Facebook to like message like and find out who was gay. Back in that day, you could like search gay people up who had said, you know, man interested in man. You could search like that. So I had found Greg and knew he was in my courses and like messaged him and was like, hey, like we should hang out sometime and study together. And yeah, at that time I was like not prepared to tell anyone, but was like very sure. Maybe not sure I was gay, but was at least sure I was bisexual and that I was like interested in hooking up with men. But yeah, I remember being in public with Greg talking, and if he ever talked, because he was openly gay, if he ever talked like loudly about gay things or being gay, I would like get so scared. I'd be like, no, shh, calm down. Like, you don't need to yell at me. You like, want to have sex with a man.
You're still mad at me for yelling, though.
Well, okay, Greg.
Do you think people are watching you all the time?
Greg has also voice modulation issues.
Yeah, I do. I'm very loud.
But yeah, no, that's also my more like introverted kind of insecurity about like disturbing other people. But just to say, like, my interpretation of being gay was like, I will do this in private until it boils over and I can no longer. And it was like once we started actually dating, I was like, okay, I now have a boyfriend. I should start telling people. Otherwise, it's going to be like so much harder and more awkward. But up until that point, I was like, I can, you know, have sex with men or hook up with men and no one really needs to know because there's no strings attached, basically. And then after that, yeah, it was like, okay, I slowly came out after that. But kind of looping the question back to like how you were talking about Rosie and coming out, I don't think Survivor like really played a role in my queerness other than...
Oh, wow. Imagine.
Well, no, but I often think about how like TV has evolved over the years and how the representation of gay men, I don't know that it's like drastically changed, but watching my family and parents specifically, like their interpretation of the gay men on those shows, I think I've seen morph a lot over time. And so I'm sure, I don't know, I can't remember specific examples, but I'm sure there were derogatory comments made towards somebody like Richard Hatch without the intention of like saying that being gay is wrong or awful, but like those kind of, you know, you're watching TV with your family and like a joke gets made at the expense of like a gay character who maybe is like not as athletic or something like that. And so I feel like I was always listening and watching, and I remember a turning point for me was Modern Family, which I'm sure it was for a lot of people, was when I realized...
The white gay renaissance yeah, of Modern
well,
Family.
Well, because that's when I think it changed for my family. Like, and I don't want... My family wasn't, like, overly homophobic or anything like that. Like, we've had... I have queer aunts in my family, so no one was ever intentionally doing these things. But that was kind of the first time when I saw my family, like, love gay characters.
So you weren't a Will and Grace family?
No, my family didn't watch Will and Grace, and I never really did either, so... Yeah, I think Survivor kind of like was that gradient changing over the years as I could see like their own cognitive behavior change when they saw gay men on screen.
Yeah, well, representation matters.
Yeah, representation does matter. And it's nice because over the seasons of Survivor, you get different kinds of gay people going on it as well. They don't get as pigeonholed. But yeah. I mean, obviously, once I came out, they were, like, very astutely aware of all these issues that they would never say those things. But up to that point, I think it was, like, a barometer for me of, like, how they felt about gay characters.
Oh, wow. What was it like? Can you describe for someone who hasn't seen Modern Family, what was it? What was going on the show? And, like, how did you feel about it? Like, before your family started being like, oh, yeah, that's cool. We like that. Like, did you see the characters on there? And were you like, I identify with this or maybe not?
Yeah, I think, like, I don't know that I... Like, they were different than me. I mean, I found myself in both of them, and I, in some ways, like, I'd always laugh that, like, I was Mitch of the two and Greg was Cam, because Cam was, like, this, like, over the top, like, everyone loved Cam, and Mitch was, like, the neurotic, like, kind of more introverted, dirty one. And I think I did, like, identify. It was just cool to see that such a... I guess Will and Grace was a mainstream show, but to me, I had never been part of, like, a cultural phenomenon. Not part of it, but, like, in it, watching a show, loving it, and then knowing that it's, like, the most popular show on TV. And so I think at first I was like, is this awkward? Like, you know when you watch, like, a sex scene in a movie and your parents are there, you feel, like, incredibly awkward? I feel like at first I still kind of felt that way when Modern Family came on, where I'd be like, ah, the gay characters are, like, acting gay. And that was something that I had to deal with myself as well. But so did my family. And then to see that they actually were endeared to these characters and that they were laughing out loud and finding them really funny and not like they weren't being problematic about it, I think is what, I don't know, made me feel so much closer to my family.
It came on TV literally when you came out.
Yeah.
Right? Like it started
like around that same time.
Around the same time. I think the one thing about that show, clocking it, is that I think we forgot how popular it was. It was so huge amongst all age groups. It felt like people...
Yeah, and it wasn't like a gay show. It just had two characters that were gay.
But one thing I would say, too, is it really was like... it popularized the idea that queer people could live like a very hetero norm life. Like, that's mm-hmm. another thing. Like, they were a couple who had a house who were going to have a kid. It was about having a family. And I think maybe that's something that could resonate with your family, being like, oh, maybe my son isn't going to have to fully live an alternative lifestyle, which I don't want for him. And I want him to be like normal. Like,
That's fair.
They normalized the lifestyle of being gay. Like, they had kids, essentially.
Yeah.
Whereas
that's
Will and
true.
Grace, it was like they were single. They were always like trying to get a relationship.
Like,
Jack was always
and stuff.
like could never be monogamous. It wasn't about starting a conventional, quote unquote, hetero life.
Yeah,
like, that was
fair.
Sort of the first time that was normalized on, like, an American TV show, which is always about a normal hetero life.
Right.
Well, those are pretty loaded terms, like saying, like, a normal life and, you know, saying that they're heteronormative. And it's true that the characters on the show are basically following the straight couple blueprint of, like, let's get married and settle down and be close to family and have kids. Was that something that... I don't know, like, was a more adventurous queer life something that seemed alarming or just something that wasn't of interest to you?
Well, I think that's just what you're, like, that's what was taught in the media prior to that show. That's what's always been, like, sort of, like,
right, if you,
discussion.
Even other, like, queer shows, like Queer as Folk, like the American version, is, like, a focus on, like, that alternative lifestyle that you don't need to fit into, like,
the thumpa continues. You don't want, like, it's about sort of how scary
like the rejection
it is to age.
Of
yeah.
normal society.
Which is important, but, too. Like, it's not.
Yeah, I think both are important. I think, yeah, it is so loaded because it's, like, Modern Family presented a type of gay couple that does exist, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think they were fabricating this idea that, like, no gay people are like this and we just need to make them acceptable to, like, mainstream audience. I think it was a version of queer people that we can also celebrate and be proud of.
And I was just thinking more from the perspective of, like, your parents, like, our
right.
parents.
I think, yeah, I remember, like, coming out, like, I think one of the bigger concerns for my family was that suddenly they thought I'd be so much more sexually promiscuous, or they were, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Oh, we don't want you to, like, get STI or AIDS or anything
That's
like that.
What I always say. Coming out is hard to your parents because it's like you're having to have the sex talk with your parents. It's
right.
Like, no, like, rarely do straight people
have to sit down
and I had to, like, explain to my parents, like, why I thought I was gay. I'm like, okay, well, I hooked up with girls and I hooked up with guys, and they're all of a sudden, I'm like, that's what it's actually about. It's about sex.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you're, and I think that that's why it sucks that you have to have that conversation.
But in the context of that show, I feel like it helped because, like, for me, I was like, I'm a pretty quiet person, and I, you know what I mean? I wasn't interested. I wasn't, like, chasing a lot of sexual partners. I did kind of want, or at least, like, my brain has always thought I wanted, like, a more traditional, you know, I mean, we're all conditioned to want this kind of, like, traditional family lifestyle. But my parents and family, I think, were scared once I first came out, and then Modern Family showed that, like, no, you can be that as well. Like, it played into that idea of, like, everything they probably thought about gay men before that, this kind of showed, like, no, there is a world in which, like you said, they can fit that, like, mold of what is heteronormative.
Yeah, which
but,
is, like, not necessarily
yeah, whether that's
good
or bad, but
yeah.
It just is, like, another viewpoint of maybe what they hadn't seen before.
Were there other queer characters who helped you figure out, like, okay, this is the life that could be available to me. Like, this is how to be gay.
Oh, my God. I can't think of anything.
Like, characters in general in whether it be TV or movies or anything like that?
Yeah, books or any place where you're like, okay, well, so I'm coming out, but what is that, like, going to look like?
Oh, my God. I literally came out by, like, going to the library and getting a, like, fiction book called Rainbow Boys. That was, like, it was, like, I don't even know what I would compare it to now. I'd never read any book like that. It was, like, teen fiction. Like, it was, I don't know. It wasn't well-written or anything. It was just, like, sort of, like, sexual. But that my dad actually found that book under my bed, and that's what, like, instigated him being like, we should have a chat. But, I mean, that was, like, I mean, it was important to me. I was just, like,
right,
reading
yeah.
books about kids in high school, like, banging in the locker room.
Oh,
it was, like, it would be, like, the nerdy gay guy, like, the jock's actually gay. Like, it was very simple, but, I mean, it mattered to me because at the time I was reading it and, like, getting turned on and being like, I could live this life if I just came out. So Rainbow Boys, written by I do not know who, probably a
computer. Oh my God, you need to find that. You need to go get that book from the library. I feel like this is Mitch, and I never really had, like, specific gay characters that I can think of right now on the spot, but that's
Link.
Well, that's why, gay. Like, Link isn't gay, but I honestly think often I identified with characters who were, like, a bit different. And, like, even if it was never an illusion to being gay.
Is Link different?
Well, he's, like, kind of, like, lonesome, and he has this special adventure that he has to go on that he's the one who's meant for. And even if you think of, like, Harry Potter, I don't know if that Harry Potter has, like, a queer following in any way, but it's,
J.K. Rowling would let you know if Harry Potter was gay.
that's true. Well, sure. Dumbledore, okay. But, I mean, to me, it was, like, he's somehow different. And, like, I didn't come into Harry Potter like fandom until I was quite a bit older, like in university, but then I like really identified with it, and I never thought like this is because I'm gay and he's different and it makes me feel that, but I feel like I've always gravitated towards, I mean, we all see ourselves in multitudes, right? Like I am more than just gay, so I would see myself in Link because maybe he's like a quiet person who doesn't talk much, but he's also different and like no one really understands him, but I think my queerness is part of that self-image of myself.
That's, you know, an interesting way to look at it. Like, they're both, like, a lot of the stuff that you're talking about, Link and Harry Potter, and I guess to an extent even Richard Hatch have a quality of being magical boys. Like, you know, that anime quality of like, there's something special about us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, there's other movies even with, like, female characters that I kind of felt the same way about. It wasn't necessarily about that character needing to be gay, but for them to kind of almost have some level of ostracization from whether it be society or their world that they're living in.
It's almost like every comic book movie.
Really? Yeah.
It makes you so surprising that every comic book movie is just like a white, straight person. It's like it'd be a lot more interesting and make a lot more sense if these were queer people of color, because that's literally the plot. They're an outsider.
Did you feel like an outsider? Like, were there things, I think one of you mentioned like bullying that stopped like mattering once you came out, but like, what were the things that made you feel like I'm not entirely part of this world?
For me, Greg Hare. like I just have always had a very flamboyant voice and demeanor, and I've never really tried to change myself. So I guess my whole, from grade 6 onwards, I was like bullied a lot, just like called gay and like, I had like pretty awful experiences. Nothing like ever like physically that bad, but it was very obvious to me because of the way that I was. But the way that I dealt with it is really leaning into it. I didn't try and hide myself. And I think what I'm saying is that when I came out, all of a sudden, if someone was mean to me and called me gay, I'd be like, And then I was able to fight back as them being bullied, like the bully now. But I was always a class clown. I was always like making sure that the cool people knew that I was funny and like knew that I had some sort of like worth as like a really big shield. And I just like I had used a lot of tactics then that I still even have now that I'm trying to like get rid of a little bit, because it's not always good to be so like, I'm very aware of the way people perceive me, and I like, it still matters to me probably too much, but I don't really remember what the exact question was, but I did deal with being bullied just because I sound like this.
Like, whereas did you feel different? Yeah,
you were like more mask presenting.
Yeah, for sure, but I definitely still faced a lot of that kind of like homophobia just because I was, I mean, I would play sports. I wasn't like so uncoordinated or anything, but I was definitely perceived as like more effeminate. And I think I also like identified with like nerd culture, but there's not a huge, like I'm sure there is a big crossover, but in my world, there wasn't a big crossover between like gay culture and nerd culture, apart from maybe like theater. So I like really ended up loving and finding like musical theater, because in that space, even the straight men like didn't care. And there was never any talk in that way, like negatively about like sexuality. And it was just kind of accepted that there are plenty of queer people in this space.
And that kind of actually like, going back, because I think more I get what the question was, I definitely identified as like an artsy kid in high school. And I loved visual art. And I remember thinking that was a big struggle because I also was obsessed and loved science. And there was this like dichotomy of either you choose one or the other. Mm-hmm. Like all my friends were like the artsy kids. I felt really comfortable there. I was always like a little bit different, like the music I liked, the movies I liked. I was always like into whatever was like cool and artsy. But then also at the same time, I was obsessed with like biology, physics, and chemistry, which wasn't necessarily what was fitting into my friend groups. Like everyone was like doing English essays while I was like studying for chemistry. So there is like that sort of cultural thing that frustrates me as someone. So prior to ASAP Science, I wanted to be a high school teacher, and my teachables were science and visual art. And that's like something I think even now I still try and just like, it frustrates me so much that they divide people in between art and science.
Like it's very difficult to have both those in your repertoire.
Yeah, I literally had to do an extra year at university because the courses don't match up properly. So I had to like stay longer in order to do art and science because they don't actually have them literally designed for people to do that. And that is still a continued frustration for me. And I think it's a bit of me loving science, but needing to be an artsy kid to like get by.
Was that, Mitch, was that a problem for you as well? Was that something that you're like, I want the best of both of these two sides of the brain?
Yeah, absolutely. I literally like applied to both university for science as well as for like film was the other thing I had done. And I found that I couldn't go into one or the other, but it was that dichotomy. Like there was nowhere I felt I could go to like tune both of those interests. And so even through high school, you get told like in grade 9 and 10, at least where we're from in Toronto in Ontario, you are forced to take science, but after that you choose. And I was just I chose science because I was like, okay, I can keep, you know, doing music, I can keep learning acting or those kind of things on the side as recreational hobbies, but science you can really only learn in school. But I've always found it frustrating, and to this day, like the image, and in fact in a lot of ways, like as creatives, I'd say we even still, well, as creatives and queers in the science community, it's still even difficult for us because that comes off as like a contradiction to a lot of people. Like, oh, if you're a scientist, then you should be much more rigid and following in these lines. And if you're a creative person, you probably just don't fit in here. So adding that on top of like being queer in like a very masculine heteronormative space in the first place makes it even more intense. But yeah, it starts like really young when people are told, I mean, I'm sure it's similar for like queer people who love sports and are just like, why do I feel like my queerness isn't allowed here? And why do my other interests not align with all these other people? So yeah, I definitely felt that. I still forced myself to be involved. Like in high school, all my electives would be like whether it was music or theater. And I would try really hard to like be involved in community theater outside of that, just because those groups I always felt so much safer in. But yeah, it bums me out that I wasn't able to bring them to like a higher level because I had to choose between the two when it came to university.
Did you find either in school or like afterwards with the work that you do now that you're finally basically creating your own ways of blending those things as a couple?
Yeah, like I think that's probably what we're most proud of. We managed to literally blend science and visual art and editing and film and music all into one. It's the most amazing thing. Like, I think with our job right now, being YouTubers and making content online for 7 years now as our job, and we have a business that we have employees, it can be really stressful. And it's all happened so fast that sometimes it feels like it got out of control for us. Like, I know right now there's so many things happening that our biggest struggle is that we go to bed and we're like, I didn't have control over my day. There's just too much going on. But the thing that I always go back to that makes me feel proud and makes me able to do it is exactly that. It's like, wait, I had these interests that society told me couldn't mesh, and I meshed them and made something that works. Like, you can't really ask for anything that could be more fulfilling and satisfying. And I think never could we have predicted that that could happen. I always thought, okay, I'm going to be a high school teacher, which I still want to be. I think it's the most important job in the world. But that's the way I'm going to do it. Or I'm going to do research. Or I'm going to be a painter. Like, that was like sort of, it was all separate things. Like, which one will I choose?
Yep.
And now that we're kind of doing all of those things,
it felt like
amazing.
It was like a really huge aha moment. Like and it's weird because up to that moment, like you don't realize it's possible. Like because you're told your whole life, like pick one. And I just feel like when we finally kind of came together with this idea, it was like, wait, why didn't I think of this before? Like it was the perfect melding of all those things, literally, that we loved. And that, yeah, it just kind of comes together in a perfect storm. But now it is like, that's why we feel like almost indebted to like when we meet lots of young people. And I think a lot of young people that will come to our events or things like that, and especially queer young people, see us and they're like, it makes them happy. They love music. They love art. They love science. And they can see other people in their lives or in their lives on the internet that love that too. And I think that's like a powerful thing. And that is something I think YouTube has offered to the world. You can find people like you. If you don't love your teacher in high school, you can have not alternative teachers, but you can have other influences in your life to provide you with science or art in a different way to inspire you, even if that one person at your school isn't doing it for you.
And it's a visibility thing. Like, we've met the most incredible scientists in the world because of what our job is right now. Like, we literally went to a breakthrough prize recently. And those top tier scientists that you meet, a lot of them are women. A lot of them are creative men. When you ask them what they're doing on their spare time, it's art.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, in order to be a good scientist, you need to be creative. So it's really interesting because that dichotomy is so damaging. It's like, mm-hmm. in order to be a really good creative, you need to have a scientific mind or else you end up just in the clouds. Like, yeah. there's so many reasons why they, like, benefit they should each be, other
yeah,
that it's just encouraged. So interesting and frustrating. And I just find whenever I meet scientists who I love, I'm like, what are you interested in? And it's never science. Like,
as their
like
hobby.
Outside
yeah.
of, yeah, yeah. It's, they always have these really interesting hobbies where you're like, how do you find time for that? And that's when you know they're passionate about painting mm-hmm. or writing or culture. They're all such fascinating, cool people. They're not mm-hmm. just like these like nerds in a lab who only think about science, which is what the movies want you to think.
Mm. Well, I want to, I'm so curious about when you first started dating, if that was something that you saw on the horizon, because it sounded like, I think, was it Mitch, you were looking at like who else like
oh, yeah,
found Greg online?
Yes.
And so it sounds like you just started hanging out and then one thing led to another.
Yeah. So I don't think at that time there was ever any indication or thought that we would A, ever work together or B, find this creative melding. Like
we just saw each other in science class.
Yeah. And I mean, once we started dating, I think it was clear that we both loved science. Like, we both were really into it. And we did have a lot of friends who were outside of the sciences because Greg was also in an art program and I was like doing the musicals at the university. So we had a lot of people around us who we were always trying to encourage to like, we learn stuff in class and we'd be like, we need to literally tell people about
science guys to all the queer art people at our university.
Yeah. And we'd be like, here's why you get drunk. Here's what marijuana does to your brain. It was like the stuff that they were relating to. We could see that they actually found it really fascinating when we as scientists were like bringing it into a world that they already understood. It was like a cool cross section for them where they were like, I don't like science. It's too hard. But hey, if you're going to explain something about singing to me or something about art, like that is cool to me. And so I think that was like the beginning days of what became Aesop Science, even though we never really knew it at the time.
But I also think that we are like something for me. This is more personal thing to you, but I think it's similar. Like, what I'm trying to realize now is I present as a very like carefree, like I'm like a messy guy who like, you know, likes to, especially in high school, university, likes to party. And like everyone's like, oh, Greg's here. He's the life of the party. Like he must, you know, be disheveled or whatever. But I always made sure, and I think that's like the science part, like that I always made sure I did well in school and high school, even though I smoked weed all the time, so that if my parents ever caught me, I'd be like, I'm getting 80s. Like it was that same sort of thing where it's like, I'm going to have a lot of fun. I'm going to follow my artistic perspectives, but in my back pocket, I'm always going to have this scientific degree that is that thing that I can use in the future to make sure that I'm stable. You know what I mean? And I feel like a lot of the art people around us, maybe we didn't realize at the time, but they were probably looking at us like, wow, they're hanging out with us. They're spending all this time. They're having fun. But then they're going to these science classes. Like, we were the two people doing that within our friend group. And I don't know if we maybe realized that maybe people around us were like, Greg and Mitch are doing this weird thing that we're all not doing. But I never thought of it that way necessarily.
Yeah. But then I guess it just kind of culminated once we were both at, like, we started Aesop Science once we left university.
Yeah, that's true.
And Greg had become a teacher, and I was at the time working in labs but wanted to work in film and kind of ended up meeting some YouTubers. And then from there, we just kind of brainstormed one day. We were like, we should do something. Like, YouTube's so fascinating. There are some other educational channels on the internet. That's really cool that people will choose to watch educational stuff.
But you know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to say, like, I think a lot of our friends might not be surprised that we made Aesop Science based on the way they observed
that's
us.
True.
Whereas
that's
we are
true.
More like, how the heck
like
could
like, it
kind
of just came out of nowhere. Yeah.
But they might be like, no, you
perceived
were always
as that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think one thing for me I'm trying to do is I always say that Aesop Science, like, we got lucky. And I'm trying to, like, own it a bit more so I don't end up on my deathbed, like, why didn't you enjoy and, like, take credit for the thing you did, right? Like, I think we're really good at being like, well, how did this happen?
That's true. I think a lot of people kind of do that with, like, their
imposter
lives
syndrome.
Where, it's a bit of imposter syndrome, but it's also, it's difficult to know at the time. Like, you're only ever able to, like, retrospectively look back and understand what, like, because your path is not linear, right?
You're not only able to do that, but that's a common thing to do that it'd be best to not do that. There's lots of people who are really good at being present, I think, but they have to work.
Oh, but I'm not saying that. Like, I'm saying you don't know where you're – like, you don't know where you'll be in 5 years.
Oh,
neither
true.
Do I. And so, like, what led us to Aesop Science was not random events, but me having to happen to meet those YouTubers and working with YouTubers and then you being a teacher and it kind of colliding where all of our skill sets led to this thing that didn't even exist when we started university.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This idea that you could be an online video creator that educated people and made money from that, and that could be your career. Like, we didn't grow up with that idea. So our path kind of like sidestepped here and there, which has all led to it. And we're able to look back and go, look, there's the path. See, it's so obvious. But I think at the time, it's just so hard to put together, you know?
Yeah.
But here we are, and it kind of came together.
That in itself seems like that's kind of queer culture, is like, I'm passionate about this thing. I want to do this thing. Nobody else does it. Maybe it's not allowed. I'm doing it anyway.
Yeah, that's true. Sure. Oh my God, Aesop Science is queer.
Well, it is queer. Yeah, I agree. And I'm sure that's part of our gayness and our queerness that kind of led us to maybe feel more comfortable and confident taking those risks. I'm not sure. Or just
being
more comfortable in that space of like, hey, this is not necessarily what everyone else is doing, but I'm okay to do that.
Yeah.
When you started dating in college, and like basically that was, I think, Mitch, for you, that was like the reason that you were coming out, is because you're like, okay, well, I'm dating somebody, so I probably should tell people.
There was like a week or two where I was like hiding Greg in and out of my room at like 4 a.m.
It was
like,
fine for me.
It was scary for me.
How did people react when you started coming out?
Well, I'd say with my university friends, the ones that I had just met that year, because I came out in first year, it was fine to them. Like, and I think it was so much harder for like me to address the people who had been in my life for much longer. So my close friends from high school and grade school, as well as my family, it's like I felt like I was betraying them in a way, like I had been lying to them all these years. And I think a lot of queer people feel this way when they come out, and they're like, I don't want you to feel upset that you think you were tricked all this time. But I remember being really scared, but then very surprised with my university friends, because it was just so easy. As soon as I told one, I told my roommate, and he just like made a joke and we laughed, and that was it. And then I was slowly able to tell the others. And not that any of my close friends from high school or grade school like had bad negative reactions. It just felt like the weight to it was so much more. And I kind of went in that order. Like I told my newer friends first, and then my family was last, because it's like they know you the most and they're going to feel like, did you lie to me? Why didn't you just tell me earlier, kind of thing? But yeah, it was an interesting process of like true liberation. That's terrifying at first, but as you slowly unravel it, it's just like it. I mean, I'm sure almost everyone's experienced this who's come out. It's like it's freedom. It really is. And I even to this day remember, like, I was like, oh, I just think I'm never going to tell my grandparents because they're much more religious, and it's like not worth it because like they maybe are near the end of their lives, and I'm just like, it's not worth the stress. But then they ended up finding out, and that was kind of like the last piece of the puzzle for me, where I was like, I'm free. Like I never, not never, but like I hope I never have to hide my true identity again. And it's like, again, it's one of those things you can never know how you'll feel until you do it. But looking back, I'm like, why didn't I just do that sooner?
Yeah, I hear that from a lot of queer folks of like, it feels like there's so much stacked against you. And then when you come out, you're like, oh, this is actually my superpower.
Exactly. Yeah. And you get to like love yourself in a new way. The only thing I would say, I grew up like in a somewhat religious family, and I went to Catholic school. And sometimes I think about, you know, as the gay man that I am now, if I were to, with my mentality, go back into my grade 10 body, would I come out? And sometimes a sad answer rings like maybe not, because I was in an environment where I actually think the teachers were more of the problem. Like, I think some of the kids I thought were my fear. Like, I was scared of the bullies at school. But I remember when I came out running into some of them later in life in university, and they obviously were fine with it. Maybe I would have been bullied a little bit in high school.
Abolish Catholic schools. They should not be publicly funded in Canada.
Okay. Relax. But, yeah, thinking back, that makes me really sad that it was, like, the institution of my school that actually made me feel unsafe. And maybe I wouldn't come out, even with my, you know, modern day mentality, if I was in grade 10 in a Catholic high school in that same situation I was before. Not because I had teachers like openly saying overly homophobic things, but just that uncertainty. And I think that's like a really dark thing that sometimes I think about and I don't like to think about too much.
Yeah, I was going to ask like what advice you would have to younger you. And it sounds like one of those pieces of advice is like, things are going to get real good, but for now, be careful. Take care. Look after yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like I would never presume to say like coming out will always solve your problems and make you feel happy. That's the goal. And I think it does in the long term for almost everyone who comes out. But there's certainly situations out there, and that could be your family, that could be your school, that could be your community, where maybe it's actually not safe. And maybe when you are old enough to go live on your own or move somewhere, that might be the right time for you. So it's not so much about like coming out as soon as possible, more than just like understanding yourself and then understanding your environment and doing it when it feels right.
Mm. Well, yeah. So what are you like looking ahead now that you've had these milestones of like meeting each other and building a business around the stuff that you're passionate about? Do you have like a sense of like what comes next that you've got that freedom? Like, what are the goals you have now that you are, you know, free to like really like who you are and what you're making?
Yeah, that's our big question. That's like sort of what we're going through right now.
Yeah, you kind of like never truly figure it out. And that's what you realize, I think, on this like life path, no matter, I don't know, you kind of envision yourself like, hey, if we make this YouTube channel more successful, that's going to solve everything. And then we're going to know that's our sure path. But life is just like cycles. And I think we're definitely in the middle of a cycle right now where we're like.
I would say the word science communicator is not something that I ever really knew until this experience that now I would say, okay, that's something I want to stay with.
Yeah, I think forever I'll be passionate about sharing science and being engaged with science, maybe even if I'm not the one who's disseminating it. But I don't know, like, don't you feel like there's so many other sides of me I haven't explored?
I think where we are I think one thing is that we work on this business together. It's very stressful as a couple that I think there's like a bit of us trying to be like, how do we continue forward and separate our lives a little bit? And that could maybe be the separation. Like, I think I love this idea of being a science communicator continuing, but you have told me you have a lot of really interesting talents and goals outside of science that I think maybe would be, I don't know, I shouldn't speak for you.
No, yeah,
you
no, know what I mean? I think I'm a little like lost in that way because I was so connected to like, you know, music and like theater and those kind of things in my life. And when ASAP Science took off, it was so exciting. And I was like, hey, of course I'm going to like jump on this line that's going at hyperspeed. But now that it's been some time, you start to realize like, oh, dang, like it's kind of weird that I haven't, you know, there's been 7 years where I've kind of neglected these other passions that just kind of sit dormant in you. But you almost feel a little unfulfilled if they're not tapped into. Like, I don't know if you feel that way about
art.
Like,
yeah, because whereas I, Greg, all I ever wanted to be was a high school science teacher who painted on the weekends. So it's a little simpler for me because all this science communication has done is elevated me outside of the classroom. And my main thing I miss is just being around kids and like that sort of like personal relationship that I love to have with students. That's the biggest missing thing in my life. But outside of that, I just feel like I'm like, oh, my God, I am kind of a science teacher.
Yeah.
In a way.
And I think like between the two of us, like I definitely have like a more toxic relationship with maybe perfectionism. And that's kind of, I know like Greg mentioned the book. I can't think of the name right now.
What
book? The one with talking about shame in gay people.
Oh, The Velvet Rage.
The Velvet Rage. Sorry. Thanks. And that book does talk a lot about like, the sort of different phases that some gay men might feel they go through and why so many gay men are like really successful because they use their successes as a means to conform and fit into society or feel like they're, you know, worth something, like they value their selves outside of themselves, like as an external loci of themselves. And so I feel like that's kind of a journey that I'm still going on because I've always been like, hey, I need to really prove to people that I am valuable. And to do that, I'm going to like work so hard and I'm going to be the best person at this thing and I'm going to take over everything. You know what I mean? That's kind of and make a lot of money. And so now I'm realizing like that is never the journey that makes you happy, but you think it is when you're young. And so now I've done that in a way and I kind of have to figure out how do I undo it without letting go of the parts of it that are still important to me and that I do love.
Yeah,
and so
hard.
And I think every
we're all like that
yeah
though,
I think
yeah.
every queer person and straight people as well go through that journey of
sure.
finding themselves and realizing what is actually important, but definitely like my queerness is at the root of why maybe I didn't feel worth enough that I have always chased this and it's become so ingrained, you know.
Yeah.
And I think I'm at that stage now where I'm like, we have a great business, but it isn't the thing alone that can make me happy.
Yeah.
And I need to start finding those things a little. And that's why like music and stuff resonates with me again, because I'm like, those are the things that never were intended to make me money or never intended to. Well, maybe some of them I were like, oh, maybe I'll be successful with them. But it's more like there's like that passion that brews inside you, even if it doesn't become your thing.
Yeah, I think that's something that's particularly challenging for not to stereotype, but for millennials is separating the accomplish like achievements, like capital A achievements, like business and money and the trappings of wealth and all that stuff, from like just feelings of personal value. It just seems like something that and I don't know why this is, but it is really challenging to be like, okay, how does life have worth outside of the things that I get like graded on?
And yeah, it is. It is like this. I don't know that it's exclusively a millennial problem, but I agree in the sense that I've always felt like entitled to not do work that does not fulfill me. And so, and I think a lot of people get in this trap, and I'm sure like my parents and other generations older than us would be like, no, you work to have a stable life and provide for the people around you and your family. And that has nothing to do with your passion. But yeah, there's like this kind of, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but definitely I've always felt the need to be chasing my own dream in my job and the rest of my life.
Is there something that you're looking forward to that is just strictly not a job? Just like, this is just for us. This is just fun. This is like playing Zelda or I don't know, like just like vegging out or maybe making something that's just for you.
I think, yeah, there are a slew of those. I think that's where I'm at in my journey right now is figuring out exactly how to do that. Like the hardest part for me right now is like, because we've built this thing, it is like a tornado in itself and it requires so much time. And I'm like, how do I begin to let go of that and allow myself to have time outside of this to do those creative things? Like, yes, if anytime a new Zelda game comes out, I have no problem letting go of everything. And I'm like, I'm just going to take a few weeks off and like have to play this game now. But I think for me, it is like, maybe it's music and performing is what I miss. And for you as well, Greg, like, I think part of it is that performative aspect in front of a class, like having that more tangible human interaction versus we live and work on the internet now.
Yeah, that's what I do miss. I miss literally just hanging out with kids. It would just make me so happy because they're so funny and smart and cool. But for me, it's like interesting because, yeah, I've started to really, like, I now do stand-up comedy in Toronto all the time, and I've been trying to figure out how to mix science and comedy. It's a really random thing that I just started doing at a time where I was feeling. So I am very aware of the fact that I need to be creative. If I don't do something creative, I get bored and I get like depressed. So there was a time where I was like, okay, this seems easy. Comedy, like you don't have to mix paints to start painting. You could do it at any time. You could be writing jokes on the subway. So I just kind of started and didn't think about it. And now it's been a year and I'm so wrapped up in it. I have like a live show now that I'm doing in Toronto. And it started to stress me out a lot. And then literally I went to therapy. My therapist was like, remember when you started this as a hobby? Like, just remember that. And then since then I've been like, oh my God, I love this so much. Just thinking, okay, this is my time to have fun. Like, yeah, it's going to be about science, but that's because I'm a science teacher. That's what I want it to be about. I would way rather try and make science funny than just try and be funny. So it's sort of like bleeds into work a little bit, which I don't necessarily like. So I just have to consciously be like, this is your hobby. I'm meeting a bunch of cool people, also a bunch of insane people who are toxic. Well, keep away from me. They're listening. You know who you are. I've always known that I need to be creative and I need to either be painting. Right now it's comedy, but I always know I've needed those things and I'm good at getting them. But for sure, balancing work in our life is our biggest struggle because there's just always endless things we could be doing. Mm-hmm. But I do think that having a hobby outside of your work is so important. And I think lots of people have that maybe more naturally because they go to work, they don't even enjoy it. They come home and they live their life. The hard thing is that I think we've really enjoyed our work for a long period of time.
Yeah. I think in some ways, like, I'm excited for the evolution of our relationship at this point because we've gone through so many weird phases where, like, you know, we met in university doing totally, well, not separate things, but we never anticipated to intertwine our lives to this degree. And now we work together. All our friends are the same. We have this business together. And now we're at a phase where we're like, how do we grow to that next
stage?
That's
also almost why I started doing comedy, too. I was like, I need something outside of you. And it's it's helpful because now I'm, like, not home at night.
Right. And now I can go, like, how was your night?
Yeah,
instead of being like, I've been with you for 24 hours every day. But, yeah, I think that's exciting. It's, like, scary in some ways where you're in this relationship and work and not totally sure where it will go. But hopefully that's exciting as well, that it's, like, the possibilities are kind of endless.
Yeah. And, you know, it's something that I think couples who work together, like, it can be a perilous thing, but it's true what you're saying. Like, you can discover the value of having your own things so that when you get back together, you're like, let me gossip to you about this thing that only the two of us understand because of our weird couple shorthand. But it really, like, it is a healthy thing to have some of that, division there. So you can just pursue your own thing and try something new.
That's always my advice for couples, but it's so funny because so many couples, that's not what they need. They're like, we don't have any time for each other. I don't even understand that. Mine is like, travel alone, get away from me.
But I think, like, wouldn't you agree that, like, most couples probably do over long periods of time fall into that, and then I think we're at that stage now.
The honeymoon phase of a relationship ends, and then it's like you need to
And you kind of lose yourself in becoming each other, and now we're at that phase of, like, how do we refine our individuality while still remaining, like, a powerful couple kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure.
And by powerful couple, I mean, like, you know.
Power.
I mean, like, within our own relationship, not outside of it.
Yeah. So where are the places people can find your work and maybe see you doing some stand-up?
Ooh. Well, our YouTube stuff is just like ASAP Science on YouTube, and we have a podcast called Side Note, if that's what you're getting at. Mm-hmm. And then, Greg, where can they watch you do comedy?
Yeah, that's so funny. Like, this stand-up thing, I've been doing it for a year, and I'm just like, even everyone in stand-up is like, what's wrong with you? Like, I'm so like, I'm shy. Like, I don't tell anyone. Like, a lot of people, like, find out in these weird ways where they're like, what?
Like why didn't you invite me to that?
But in Toronto, I do stand-up a lot. I post where I'm doing it on my Instagram, which is at whalewatchmeplz. It's like a weird handle. Mm-hmm. But I now am starting a monthly show in Toronto. It's called Lunch Comedy with my friend. The first one we just released and sold out, which is awesome. So we're going to hopefully start finding maybe bigger venues. But it happens every month. That'd be a cool place for people to come if they're in Toronto / touring the amazing city of Toronto. People need to come to Toronto. It's amazing. Not when it's cold. Actually, come when it's cold. You could do really cool things like suffer.
I will say, like, there seems to be, like, just a tremendous amount of very exciting art and culture happening in Toronto these days. So, as an American, I look with great jealousy to the north.
It's the most amazing city.
Yeah, honestly. Yeah. We love Toronto. We've been pitched to move many, many times to either like LA or New York, but Toronto will always be home. We can always travel to those places and work, but we truly, I don't know. Obviously, we grew up in this, Greg grew up literally in Toronto, but it's just such a great place.
It's a city of neighborhoods. If you ever come here, you have to leave downtown and go to all the neighborhoods. It's a hard city to, I guess, it doesn't smack you in the face, but it's the best.
Seattle, where I live now, is similar, and it's very Toronto-esque at the moment because we've got a snowstorm going on. But it's cute. It's got neighborhoods.
It's cold. It's fun.
It just feels like home.
Yeah, Seattle, I've heard, is similar. Chicago apparently is quite similar to Toronto. I don't know. I've never been to either of those places, but that's what I've read in the New York Times.
That's great. Well, I hopefully I will find some time to get out to Toronto. I haven't been, so I'm looking forward to like having a reason to go and discover your beautiful city.
Yes, come. Spring, summer, fall.
Good to know.
Yeah, winter is a bit of a mess, but all the other seasons are great.
Awesome. Well, Greg and Mitch, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was a great combo. You made me be like, oh yeah, okay, we're okay, we're okay.
Good.
Thanks again to Mitch and Greg for joining me. My recommendation this week is to check out something that we talked about, Rosie O'Donnell's support of live theater throughout the 90s and early 2000s, I think. You can easily search for YouTube videos of Rosie O'Donnell and Broadway guests over the years. There's clips of Seasons of Love from Rent. Rosie does a medley of Broadway tunes on her last episode. She's got guests from Annie and Titanic and Footloose. One of my favorites is On the Town with Jesse Tyler Ferguson of Modern Family, which we also discussed. In a sailor costume, but mostly that number features Lea Delaria doing a lot of singing and dancing, and at the end of it, when Rosie comes out to meet the performers, she is clearly so much more interested in Lea Delaria than in Jesse Tyler Ferguson. It's very sweet. Big thanks to everyone for all the reviews of the show, and thanks to the supporters who make monthly bonus episodes like this possible. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to check out those backer rewards. You can also check out my other podcast, Queens of Adventure, featuring drag queens on an epic Dungeons & Dragons quest. That's at queensofadventure.com. Please reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show. I'm on Twitter and Facebook, or sewerspodcast@gmail.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin McLeod of incomptech.com, licensed under a Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.